So, high noon again, Tuesday, at this rather special time. I have to blame the gods for giving me those lecture times. Wednesday morning at 8 and Tuesdays at noon. Well, okay, good. Let's make the best out of it. Welcome again to Social Computing, Social Gaming. If we take a step back and just try to remind ourselves where we are in the lecture, why we're doing this, what we're doing, and what's the purpose of that, we're going to come to the following conclusion. Okay, so what we said was, okay, in essence, we landed up here in network analysis because we are interested in understanding long-term social context, right? And the most prominent example for long-term social context was social networks, right? So formalizations of social relations that have a dynamics which is rather in the range of weeks or months or even years than in the range of minutes and seconds, right? That's why we ended up here. The stuff that happens in minutes or seconds will concern us later in the lecture. And what we did as a starting point was to discuss centrality measures. And this is one of three chapters out of the social network analysis subdomain here in the lecture. And the second part will be on dense subnetworks. Third one will be on graph clustering. And then we leave the realm of networks and graphs for a second. We're going to come back to this in a more interesting fashion later on. Okay. So for those of you that are not really glad about graph theory, there is hope. There's light at the horizon, but still, we have to go through that tunnel. Okay, good. Last time we said, okay, why are we potentially interested in dense subnetworks?
Hi.
Hi. Kro, my name. Hi. I'm the lecturer. Okay, good. And why are we here? We said we're interested in finding groups, okay, because groups are the logical next level that has to be regarded in, or is regarded by many sociologists. And for us, there are two ways to kind of compute groups in such networks. And the first approach was via clustering techniques, via data mining techniques. This is the one we're going to look at in the next lecture. And for the moment, we're interested in graph prototypes or network subnetwork prototypes. And we said, okay, well, it's always the goal to find subnetworks that are dense in a certain way, that have certain properties beyond density. And those were listed on previous slides, and we always formulated this in the clustering paradigm. So what we want to find is subnetworks that have a high intra-cluster coherence while having a low intercluster coherence or a high intercluster decoherence. Okay. And cliques are a natural candidate because they are perfectly dense. Okay. So a clique is a complete subgraph. So every node in the clique is connected to any other node. Okay. We said, okay, cliques are perfect because they're perfectly dense, the minimum degree as well as the maximum degree as well as the average degree is equal to U minus 1, where U is the extension of the clique. And they're also perfectly compact in terms of involved diameters because the diameter of a clique is trivially 1. Okay, and they're also perfectly connected since they are if the extension is K, they are K minus 1 vertex and edge connected. OK, Okay, so that's really a structure that's virtually indestructible by taking away nodes or edges. So, and that's what also confirms our sociological intuition. So a circle of five friends would not automatically break apart if one of them goes like for studying abroad or something. Yeah. And it also doesn't break apart if, for the moment being, two of them happen to not like each other for a certain time. Okay. And that's what this, perfectly compact here formalizes. Okay. Okay. So, and, our intuition already tells us if a graph as a total has a certain density, then we expect cliques to occur, or we expect this graph to have cliques as subgraphs. And there are lots of results that specify what we can expect. So if the number of edges is larger than half of the V squared, which is the kind of maximum number of edges that you can have, times this correction factor that is almost one for large case, then we know we can guarantee that this this graph contains a clique of size k, right? So social networks tend to be dense in a certain sense, and the topology is quite different from just random graphs, as we will see. But however, there are many connections. And thus we can expect to, even large cliques to actually exist in social networks. And you can, for example, do experiments on how dense groups, as Facebook groups, for example, are in terms of their network density. And you'll find that except for groups that have a mere labeling function, most of the groups that exist have actually a high density. Okay, so what we can see is that groups can non-trivially overlap. Even maximal cliques can overlap non-trivially without being identical, and that's also something nice. It's also something that confirms to our sociological intuition, right? Because people would normally belong to many groups, many circles of friends. Okay. Now, we can ask ourselves, how many cliques are there in a graph? And the answer is presumably very many. Okay, so you can construct graphs that have an exponential number of cliques, exponential in the number of nodes, right? And this famous theorem by Moon and Moser states that the upper bound is that they found was exponential in the number of nodes, okay? So I don't know of any better lower bound or whatever. So in essence, yeah, not logically following from this theorem, but like suggested by that theorem in a certain sense, is that we may expect an even exponential number of such cliques, okay? Which in turn already kind of gives us the intuition that it's hard to find all the cliques in a graph. In fact, it's an NP hard problem, but it's always as our. If the structures that you're after are meaningful, then in almost all the cases, getting them is hard. Okay, and if the structure is easy to get, then it's less meaningful, as we will see. Cliques have two other probabilities that we are after. They are closed under exclusion, meaning that if one of the friends in the clique kind of moves away, the rest is still a clique. That's also makes sense in the sociological domain. And cliques are nested, meaning that a clique of size n is naturally split up into n minus 1 cliques of size n minus 1 and so on. Yeah. So best example is that each clique can be decomposed in triangles, right? And even dyadic binary dyadic relations can be considered simple cliques, although we in most cases won't count them as such. Okay, and that's also according to intuition, because in a group that's comparatively large, let's say k equal to 10 or what, people have the tendency to split that up in subgroups, at least from a cognitive point of view. So it's important that if some of the clique members are missing for whatever reasons, then the rest would still be a clique. That's, yeah, in terms of this closed under exclusion, but also in terms of that all the substructures in the subcliques in the clique are also cliques. So these are two properties that we might even demand of groups, or demand of dense subnetworks that we accept as groups here. Now, one could come and say, cliques, why are we so strict? Why does everybody in the clique has to know, or is required to know each other member in the clique? Can't we relax that a bit, okay? And there are at least three distance-based relaxations that people devised, okay? And these are the N-clique, the N-club, or the N-clan. And the N-clique is defined if for all the pairs in that structure, the distance between them is smaller or equal than N, okay? However, this small g here is the crucial point with the N-cliques, because this distance is not necessarily evaluated with respect to paths and nodes in the substructure, but evaluated with respect to the original graph. Okay, so that implies that an N-clique does not even have to be connected at all, yeah? Because you're evaluating the distance with respect to the original graph, okay, and not to the substructure. That's why people came along and said, that's maybe not so nice. So what we want is an N-club where the diameter of the induced subgraph is smaller or equal than N, okay? That seems to make more sense, because now we're bound to evaluating distances within the substructure. Okay. And then, last definition, N-clan is the case if the structure is a maximal N-clique and an N-club, right? And As you already read, this critique in terms of the N-cliques makes them rather useless, but the question is, are these other relaxations reasonable? Okay, good. Good. However, what we can see if we think about it is that some of them are at least easy to find. For example, the N-clan is easy to find because we would just have to drop all N-cliques that have a diameter greater than N, okay? And the N-clubs are a bit harder to find because you have to regard all the induced candidate subgraphs with a diameter less than N. So from these definitions above, it's easy to see that N-clans aren't necessarily N-cliques, so that's something that's implied here. And N-clubs are contained within N-cliques, maybe it's also to see. N-clans are N-clubs, which is just by definition. And what intuition does not tell us is that there are N clubs that are not N clans. Good. So that's very abstract. So let's just do an example, right? So up above here, I repeated these definitions for these three clique relaxations. And on the left side, just to to list some of the cliques or give you an example of cliques. Here's this blue graph, and some of the cliques that are in there are listed here. Okay, so it's the triangles 1, 3, 2. It's this triangle 5, 3, 4, 5, 6, 4, and so on. So, and even this 4 clique here is also a clique. Okay, but what about these red substructures? Okay, so let's look at the red graph and try to find them. Good. So, what are two cliques? Okay, and my statement is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is an N clique, or is actually a 2 clique, yeah? So, the distance between any pair in that substructure is smaller or equal than 2. Now, you might say, this is a lie because 4 is clearly 3 edges away from 5, okay? But here, this G comes into the game because you're allowed to evaluate the distance with respect to the original graph, meaning we can make a detour over this 6, although it's not in this first 2 clique, okay? So that's why 4 and 5 are also have a distance of smaller or equal than 2 in the original graph. Now, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, yeah, here I think it's clear that this is also an N clique. And, what are collapse? So the diameter must be smaller or equal than 2 within the substructure. So 1, 2, 3, 4 is something we cannot include, we cannot include 5, because this would only be possible if we had this, if we had a 2 clique. And actually 1, 2, 3, 5 is also a 2 club, okay? What we see is that this 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is also a 2 club, because the diameter within the substructure itself is smaller or equal than 2. Good. And in order to be an N-clan, the substructure needs to have a diameter smaller or equal than 2, so it must be a 2 club. But out of the set of 2 clubs, we're required to select those that are also an N-clique and, what's crucial, a maximal N-clique. Okay? Now let's look at this one here. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah? 1, 2, 3, and 4. So it's clearly an N-clique, or is it? Yeah, it is. It's a 2 clique, okay? If I'm not completely mistaken. However, it's not maximal, since you can take this 5 and add it, okay? So what we would in essence would have to add here, yeah, is here adding maximal, okay? Just to be sure, okay? So if people mean structures, they would normally mean maximal substructures, okay? Because it just doesn't make sense to have non-maximal structures, right? I mean, can make sense for certain things, but from a point of view of computing groups, I would say you're always after the maximal one. So 1, 2, 3 is a 2 club, but it's not a 2 clan because it's a non-maximal N-clique, yeah? Otherwise, it would be listed here as well, okay? And that's why these notions, well, these it's an example for the last statement down here. Good. Now, you might say, okay, good, well, clubs, clans, dingens, bummens, so what's the use? Are they worth something? Can I compute them? Okay, good. Before we want to devote ourselves to the question whether we can compute them, first of all, we have to be aware that this N is a critical parameter. Okay? Remember what I told you about 6 degrees of separation. If anybody knows anybody else over 6 edges, right, or a distance of 6, I should say, is it meaningful to have N equal to 3? The answer is clearly no. I mean, with N equal to 3, you're almost at the size of Bavaria or even Germany, network-wise. So since we are mainly focused on small groups, sociological small groups, it doesn't make much sense to come up with a large N, okay? And what's also a point that's negative about them is that they are not nested and not closed under exclusion. So if I take away one element out of a N clique or N club or N clan, then it may be the case, or it is the case, that it's not necessarily at such a structure anymore. Yeah. So they're not closed under exclusion. And they're also not nested, meaning that if you take subsets of this node set forming one of these, then these subsets would not in their turn form one of these. So they're not nested. And we said that this is something that we want to have because that's sociologically meaningful. Okay? Good. However, as we will see, they're easy to compute, but, well, this is a conflict, okay? So don't be tempted to use things because they're easy to compute, right? If they don't model what you want, they just don't make sense. And all I was saying was, or all I want to say with these things is that they are not so ideal, maybe for our purposes. However, they're used in sociometry, and but for our purposes, they're better candidates, as we will see. Yeah. Now, you might be tempted to say, okay, well, if N cliques, clubs, and clans are not what we want, so let's get back to cliques, right? Let's be strict again. And the question is, what can we do in terms of cliques? Typically, if you're doing graph theory, you're satisfied if you have a time complexity in the range O of M plus N. Yeah. So, which means that if the edges are linear in V, you have a time complexity of V in total. However, E would in most cases be in the order of magnitude of V squared or N squared. So the edges are the thing that dominates the time complexity, okay? However, not everything is hard, okay? So if you're given a subset, determining whether it is a clique can actually be done in O of M plus N, as well as many other computing primitives that we need for algorithms, okay? So if you want to know whether U is a clique, what you would need to do is you would have to test all the pairs of nodes if they're connected. Well, so that would assume that you have a time complexity in the order of magnitude of V squared. Yeah. But the advantage is that once you have searched E edges, you can stop because there are not more edges than that. Okay. So that's why you'd have O of E plus V in essence for this first primitive. Second primitive, if you want, you're given a clique and you want to know, is it maximal? Okay. Now, what you need to do is you need to test all the remaining vertices in the graph, whether they're connected to all vertices in the substructure. Once again, if you've tested E edges, you can stop. That's why you end up in the same time complexity class. Now, this is a bit more exotic, and we will use it in an algorithm later on. Let's assume you have a sorting, an order on the set of vertices. And with the help of that order, you can lexicographically order cliques, order cliques as well, right? And what you might be interested in is finding the lexicographically smallest maximal clique that contains a clique that you're given, okay? So lexicographic ordering is the one that you basically find in a telephone book, okay? And, okay, good. We can do this. We have to just once again test the vertices that remain in ascending order, and you have to check whether they're connected to all of them in the graph. Okay? And as before, if you have searched E edges, the search is over. Good. So these are three primitives that can be used in algorithms. Now the question is, okay, isn't the world perhaps easy? Are cliques easy? Okay, not so. So, if we look at a classic problem in complexity theory, namely the clique problem, and in that clique problem you're given a graph and a number, and it's a decision problem that just wants you to decide the problem whether this graph has a clique of size at least k. And what you find is that this is an NP complete, time complete problem. And if you could solve this, you could, if you could solve the decision problem, you could necessarily, or you could easily do binary search and then come up with a solution to find the maximal k just in order of magnitude log times this time t that you need to solve the decision problem. Log comes from the tree-based binary search. Okay. Now, why is that? Okay. Do the game students have theoretical computer science this semester? Yeah, you have. And I presume that you're just talking about reducing something on other one decision problem on another. Stuff like that? You do that? Presumably, okay. It's always a mysterious question if someone asks you, aren't you currently talking about this and this and this in the lecture? Maybe, I don't know. Okay, good. So, as you know, in complexity theory, P is a subset of NP, and NP has an overlap with the NP hard problems. And the NP complete problems are those NP hard problems that you can map each NP problem to with a polynomial reduction mapping, okay? So, and what you always want to do to prove that something is NP complete is to polynomially map it onto another well-known NP complete problem, because then transitively you can map each NP problem to this problem that you're interested in. Okay, so if that's NP, okay, and we have P as a presumably as a subset, we don't know, and if these are the NP hard problems, right? NP hard, okay. Then we know if we want to be able to map any NP problem to, or an NP complete problem is a problem that you can map any problem to with a polynomial mapping. And if you want to prove that this is also an NP complete problem, what you need to do is just to find a polynomial mapping, because then you can transitively map it. Via a then also polynomial mapping, okay? And in case of the clique problem, the proof is a prototypical proof, because if I'm not completely mistaken, one of the first problems that has been shown to be NP complete is the satisfiability problem of simple logic, okay? So you're given a logical expression in, let's say, conjunctive normal form, and the question is, can you find a variable assignment that makes this statement true, okay? And you can map this to the clique problem if you construct a k-partite graph, and in that k-partite graph, you induce edges only then when two literals are not connected, or if it is not the same literal just by a knot, okay? Then you want to have an edge, okay? And you will see, if you think about this, that solving or having a variable assignment for the logic formula is just equivalent to have a clique of size k in that particular graph. Okay, that's easy to see, and I recommend you to look through that proof in the background reading text. Okay, good. So unless we don't have the infamous P equal to NP, we cannot expect to have a reasonable time complex algorithm that just computes us the this size K. Okay, so we cannot, we just cannot be sure whether a graph contains that. Okay, so the naive algorithm would certainly be exponential in the number of nodes. That's clear. I just have to check all the subsets, and for each subset, if I'm really naive, I would have to have a, I would have to have a quadratic complexity to check whether it's actually a clique. However, we can clearly see that this is out of range for even the smallest social networks. Okay, good. Good. So, cliques are hard. That's a problem. Okay. Now, while this naive algorithm does have a time complexity that's exponential in the number of nodes, the question is, can you get any better than that? And the answer is yes. Theoretical computer scientists come up with ever better solutions. And, what we can do is to improve the base of that logarithm from 2 to 1.4 roughly. And that's, I mean, it can make a difference if you, don't know, if you have a graph of, let's say, 100 nodes, this would really make a difference if you really need to find the cliques, okay? And this rather strange number is the result of analyzing a recursion equation, and that's the baby from discrete Strukturen that everybody loves, and that's just by having a recursive algorithm that just comes up with a clique problem and which corresponds to a recursion equation, and the solution of that would induce that rather strange number, okay? And another problem that we might be interested in is doing statistics on the size of groups, okay? So if you, let's say if you have a MMOG or something and you have a player graph and you want to know how many clans or subgroups with a size of 10 are there, or how many triangles are there, or how many four cliques are there. And if that substructure is K large, then the exhaustive search algorithm would just be V to the K, yeah, to check whether, yeah, or how many you actually have. In case of triangles, we're a bit better off than that, because by observing that if you take the adjacency matrix of a graph and compute the it to the power 2, yeah, so a to the power a squared, what you then get in the result matrix is essentially at each entry the number of walks of length 3 that actually exist in that graph. Okay, so in essence you can use that to detect the triangles. And so this involves multiplying or squaring an n times n matrix. And you might know that in computer science there are algorithms that allow you to do fast matrix multiplication. And that fast matrix multiplication would just do that with a slightly better exponent. Okay. And for the proof, I want to refer you to the background lecture, and I think it's also instructive and not too hard to just read that. And you can build on the idea of that, of these triangle detection things with this improved matrix multiplication to solve the problem for other K as well. Yeah. So it's not fully straightforward, because if you take higher powers of the adjacency matrix, what you would have to regard is that you can also have walks that go from one node to another, go back and go forth again. Yeah, because in this case we would just have walks and not paths. Yeah, but this can be handled, and so the problem is actually solvable with a slightly better time complexity here. Okay. Now, things seem to be a bit depressing at that moment in time because, there are exponentially complex algorithms involved, NP complete problems involved. Is the world really that hard? And the answer is what we can do. Let's assume you just want to do some sociological studies, and I'm going to give you an example. Okay, let's assume you're designing a location-based mobile social game, something that you might have come across, or for the social computing students, you want to design a context-sensitive location-based social media application, whatever. And what you're interested in is the mobility behavior of persons. And you ask yourself the questions, well, are friends more likely to visit the same places than any other persons, okay? And in order to do that, what you need to do, you just need to compare the similarity. It just doesn't make sense to me. So if you talk all the time, why you're here? It doesn't make sense. Just doesn't. If you talk about the stuff that's going on, other people want to hear it. I just tell you because others feel disturbed by this, and they've told me. So it's not just my fantasy, okay? So if you talk about something else, it just isn't logical, right, to do so all the time. Do you agree? Okay, cool. So don't do it, please. All right? Is that okay? Are we done with that? Okay, cool. Perfect. Okay, good. So if you're interested in these questions, you can just compare the similarity of the trajectories of friends with the similarity of any other random pairs of people, and you would find that in essence they are more similar. But you might say, okay, I've seen that for friends, but what about groups of people? Are location patterns more similar in groups than if you just take any other random subset? And what you find is, yes, they are, okay? But in order to do so, you need to take your friendship graph of your social media applications and try to compute a lot of meaningful subgroup structures. You don't care too much what they actually are. You don't care too much whether you got all of them, but the problem is you have a graph, and you just want to have 1,000 cliques at whatever costs, okay? And the good news is that we don't have an algorithm that gives them all to you in reasonable time, but what we have is an algorithm that lists all cliques with a polynomial time delay. And that means that the algorithm spits out cliques, and between two spitting out events, there is just polynomially much time that elapsed, okay? And that's nice because these algorithms keep on spitting out cliques very fast, and so you can expect to have at least some cliques if you wait enough time. And the question is, how does that work? And in essence, it's rather simple, although the slide seems a bit weird. But if you think about it, it's not too complicated. So what you do is you construct a tree, and while you're constructing it, you're also traversing it and spitting out and spit out the cliques that you find. And how do you construct that graph? Okay, so it's a binary tree, meaning that each node has only two children. Okay, and if the original graph has n nodes, what we have in the tree is n levels, okay? And at each level of this tree corresponds to exactly one node, okay? And we're continuously broadening the set of nodes. And in order to do that, what we need to have is a sorting of the nodes. So we have to have some order, right? In essence, in case of these social networking things, it could be like a user number or something. Okay, so we're continuously considering deeper levels, and each deeper level is arrived at by considering a new node in addition. Okay, and what we want is that the nodes at level I contain the maximal cliques that correspond to that set of nodes, right? And I miss a curly bracket here, okay? So nodes at level I correspond to maximal cliques that only make use of the nodes that are allowed at that level, okay? Now, how do we get from level I to level I plus one? And that's just all about, that's all about there is to constructing the tree. Okay, now, at level I plus 1, I have to consider VI plus 1 as a new node, okay? And what I want is, I have some clique, U, let's call it, and there are just two cases. First case, this newly considered VI plus 1 is also adjacent to all the nodes in U, and that means that U unified with this new node is also a maximal clique, but now on the new level, okay? And in that case, we would set this newly found maximal clique as the single child of U, and we're done. And if VI plus 1 is not, does not broaden the clique in that sense, we'd have to do something slightly more complicated. So obviously, if I take V plus 1 and add it, there must be some vertex in U which is not adjacent to this new one, yeah? Because otherwise, we would be in case 1, okay? So what we surely know, however, is that in this new broadened set of nodes, the original clique U is certainly also a maximal clique, and that we take as the left child, okay? Now, if there are some nodes that are not adjacent to this new node, we can just take them out of U, add V plus 1, and if that's a maximal clique, we would be fine off, because then it's also a maximal clique in here. Now, the only potential difficulty is that we might reach this particular new maximal clique, this one that we constructed here, via very many of these U's, okay? So we could have many U's leading to this. So what we take is we want to add it to some node U prime that it's the lexicographically smallest clique that has this new clique as a child, okay? And if we do that, we're finished, okay? So these are all the cases. Either case one, so taking V plus one and adding it to the original clique is also a clique, then we'd have this case. Or if there are problems, we would have to have two new children nodes, and we would have to solve this nice problem here that we said it's easy to solve. Okay, so that's the one down here. Compute the lexicographically smallest maximal clique containing U. And that is something we need to do in order to find the parent U prime here. Okay, so everything that we have is easy to do, right? And what you do is you can construct this tree in principle. And you traverse and construct the tree depth first, and you would output the leaves, okay? Because the leaves, if we remember our construction, the leaves are the maximal cliques or are maximal cliques in the original graph. So when you consider all the nodes, you're down here at the leaf level, and so the cliques that you're after would be there, okay? So you'd have to output them once you find them. And so not necessarily only here, it could also be the case that you'd have them somewhere else here. But in essence, the highest distance that you have to travel, or the longest path, would be up and down again, right? So the longest path passes over two n-1 nodes. So in essence, what we have is this complexity that's linear in n, and then we need O of m plus n time to decide which case applies and to solve the problem subproblems that are involved. Okay, so the overall delay that we can have if m is in the order of n squared is n to the power 3. And these are just the primitives that we need to solve. Okay, the cases determining left child, determining parent, and we're done. Okay, so that's just the basic functioning principle of these families of algorithms. And there are refined versions of that already on the market, which would do even better than this one. So if you're interested in questions like that in your social computing case or your social gaming case, at least you can get a number of cliques, and the time between each output of the clique is limited by a polynomial. Okay, so that's a nice thing. Good. So for the end of this part, let's just go back to our original problem. Okay, so the original problem was, can we find any substructure in the graph that is a meaningful group? Okay. And what we had, we said, okay, cliques, they're nice, but they're hard to get. And N clans, N clubs, and all these distance-based relaxations are not really cool. Okay. Now, what other relaxations can we come up with? Okay. Easiest idea that you could think of is to say, okay, cliques are hard because everybody needs to know anybody else. Okay, so why don't we allow people to at least miss some of them? Okay, so it's sufficient if I know almost all the others. And that's what gives rise to the concept of an n-plex. Okay, so it's an n-plex if the minimal degree of the induced subgraph is larger than u minus n. Okay, so we allow to miss our members, to miss up to n ties to other members. These are n plexes, and I can already tell you they're good, right? So they make good models of groups. However, they're also hard to get. Okay, same concepts as for cliques. So maximal and maximum are just defined in the same way. And what we find is that they're closed under exclusion, and they're also nested, which makes them good candidates for social groups. Okay. Okay. And if we take as this sloppiness or, cum grano salis number, if we don't take a number that's too large, I think they would really still make good groups, okay? So they're socially realistic. Okay, now the bad news. So the n-plex decision problem is also NP-complete, meaning if you want to decide for a graph whether it contains an n-plex of size at least k, it's NP-complete for all n, even for small n. Yeah, so you cannot say, okay, if I relax just a little bit, maybe it's easier than. No, it's not. Yeah, so and there are three parameters now. Three. The graph, K, and this N from the concept itself. Just an informal argument. Why would we see that? So if we could solve N-plex in reasonable time, we could also solve clique, because clique is n-plex gk1, naturally. Okay, good. Okay, now, plexes, almost as hard as cliques, but can we do something else? Okay, now, instead of stating that, oops, you may actually miss up to end ties to others, what you can say, well, I come from the other end and I say, in my group model, I want to have at least N connections. Okay, so that appears to be reasonable, and the thing is called an N core. Okay, but they're problematic. Okay, why are they problematic? Because if you take two N cores, their union would also be an N core. So these things cannot trivially overlap. And that's something that you would want for a sociological group, okay? Because it must be the case that I'm in more than one friendship circle. And if that is not possible, I think they're really not good, well-suited to for this modeling problem, okay? So if they're connected and they're maximal n-cores, they must be disjoint, okay? They're also not nested, and they're also not closed under exclusion. They don't even need to be connected if you really analyze them. However, the damn thing, if something is easy to get, it's not very meaningful. And, well, in some cases, also the other way around as here, okay? So there is a algorithm to compute these things, but as we saw, they're not really good candidates. Okay. So, in summary, this is the table that we can draw already at that moment in time. So, cliques are closed under exclusion, nested, but they're hard to compute. N-plexes, same, and N-cores don't have these nice properties, but they're comparatively easy to compute, right? The more meaningful something is, the harder it gets, okay? Good. Now, for the end, let's take a look at two other promising concepts that have, switched into the focus of the theoretical computer scientists, lambda sets and LS sets, okay? So the difference between them and the concepts that we had before is that the concepts that we had before are defined on a strictly local basis, okay? And these are defined on a non-local basis. Now, LS sets are just another formalization of this clustering paradigm that we want, okay? So we want, within the cluster, we want to have high coherence, and between the clusters, we want to have a high decoherence. So the definition is that an LS set is a network region where, internal ties are more significant than external ties, yeah? And the mathematical formalization is that all the proper subsets, so let's assume this is the LS sets, and if I regard a subset of the LS set, it has more connections to the outside, including the rest of the LS set, than the LS set in general does, okay? So we have the LS set, something, we have the rest of the graph, and if you take anything in there, it has more connections to its outside than the LS set itself, okay? You can take almost any, or you can take any subset, and you would always find that within and also to the outside, we'd have more edges than the LS set as a whole. So in a sense, the LS set is an optimum in that regard, okay? Itself does not have too many connections to the outside, but its constituents are comparatively well connected, including the interior of the LS set, okay? And what we find is that they're good candidates, and they can be computed with reasonable complexity, okay? So they seem to be some sort of compromise. Lambda sets, another concept. And this is a concept that's defined on the statistics of paths again. Okay? So, in these lambda sets, what we want is that members are connected by more paths than to nodes outside. So once again, we'd have the lambda set, we'd have two, and they're connected via more paths than to the outside. Okay? And what we want is that we want to count edge disjoint paths, because it's not very cool to have something like this where we would have only the path variations are only very local, right? So we want to have edge disjoint paths. And so the lambda set is again defined in more or less an analogous way as before the LS sets. So the minimum of the number of edge disjoint paths between any pair U and V within the structure must be larger than the maximum of this thing if we have another partner that's in the outside of the structure itself. Okay? And more or less the same reasoning applies as before. So they seem to kind of implement the clustering paradigm, and interestingly enough, they can be computed in polynomial time. Okay, so certainly these two things are not the final answer, but at least what this shows us is that there are other compromises that kind of are candidates for what we want. Okay, good. So these were just the essential, prototypes. Now we can ask ourselves, okay, good. So what's the overall account here? So the overall account was things that are nice cannot be easily computed. So can't we implement something else? And the answer is yes. What you can come up with is graph clustering. And how does that work? Okay, let's look at that. Good. So, all right. Now, good. Okay. Good. That's basically what I said just a few seconds ago. And, well, the question now is, can we come up with node clusters or groups of nodes that kind of implement the clustering paradigm, and that are meaningful social groups in a sense, or at least communities, or at least something that does make any social sense. Okay? And the family of algorithms that are concerned with things like that are graph clustering algorithms. Now, what's clustering? What's classification? Just to repeat that. So you might have come across supervised classifiers, okay? So in a supervised classifier takes a set of elements, whatever these elements are, could be nodes, cars, tables, humans, whatever, and maps this set to a set of class labels. And that's what a classifier does, and what you usually do, and why you're subsuming classifiers as supervised machine learning algorithms, is that you take a number of training examples and their corresponding class labels, and then train the classifier. And we'll see what this means. So training a classifier can have a lot of different detailed meanings. It can mean that you take a neural network model and train the weights in that neural network. It can mean that you train the weights of a support vector machine. It can mean that you train the probabilities of a naive Bayes classifier, whatever. And in what I would suggest to you is, since most of the games engineering students would not have had probability theory. That's correct, isn't it? And what I can offer you is, if you want me to give a short introductory course on probability theory, like two lectures or so, or one lecture if you want, I can do it. But you wouldn't have to decide now. So just tell your semester sprecher if you would like to have that. And if enough people are interested in this short, very short, compact course on probability theory, we can do that sometime in the evening. Okay? And I would give you proper background reading, a few pages, stuff from school that we repeat, and we're fine off. Okay? Why am I saying this? Because most of the modern classifiers that are around are probabilistic classifiers. And here we're in the realm of machine learning. And what machine learning does is, in essence, applied probability theory. Okay? And that's so fashionable at the moment in computer science. Everybody does machine learning. The social computing guys all do it. The robotics guys do it. The audio guys do it. The vision guys do it. Everybody does machine learning. Why? Because it's so convenient. Yeah? You'd have a clear model. You'd have a training schema, and they're pretty powerful in terms of their classification accuracy. Okay? Now, these are supervised learning algorithms, and the result is a classifier. Now, what we want to do is something else. We want to do unsupervised learning, and what comes out is a clustering. Okay? So, supervised, you have training examples, cars, tables, humans, and their respective classes that you use to train the model. And then the model can be used to predict class labels for new elements. In a clustering problem, nobody tells you anything about the cluster structure a priori, but the data itself must deliver you the answers. Okay? So you still have this set of items, entities, whatsoever, yeah? And what you want is to, via analyzing the structure of these items and their relations, you want to find subsets or clusters that are more dense than other subsets, yeah? And that's, you're solving the unsupervised learning problem, you're producing a clustering, okay? And in artificial intelligence, there is, and data mining especially, there is lots of uses for clustering approaches. Like, for example, text classification. Yeah. So I'm sorry. Text classification is a classification problem, but in AI, clustering approaches are also really, well known and need to be solved all the time. One example is, for example, typical data mining problem. Let's assume you are Metro, okay? This large grocery chain in Germany. And you have lots of customers. And these customers keep on paying at the respective points. And you know, at each instance of buying something, you know what people have bought, okay? So you'd have these large lists, and people bought this and this and this. Baby diapers, and whiskey are typically bought together. You can imagine why. If you cannot, you will. And yeah. And the question now is, what is your customer population like? Can they be subdivided in certain groups? Yeah. So the whiskey diaper group would be the desperate parents. Yeah. That would like to get drunk because they're so fed up with their small children crying all the time. Crying and shitting. That's what they do. And and other customer groups might be like the whatever hipster, blah, blah, blah. Why do you want to know? Because you want to do target sensitive marketing. Yeah. So it's of no use to send me adverts about whiskey or diapers. I don't have children, and I like gin better than whiskey if I have to drink something, so it's of no use, right? So what you want to do is you want to cluster these data that you have. Typical problem, and friends of mine actually do that all the time, day long. And a typical example, at least in metric spaces, is k-means clustering. You might have come across that, okay? Now, the problem is we're still in the realm of social networks, right? And there is no metric space. Everything that we know is this discrete math structure, namely the graph. So how do we do clustering in graphs? And that's what this part of the lecture is precisely about. In order to be able to do that, we need to have some notations. Okay, so we would usually start from a weighted graph. So something where the social relations, for example, have weights, like intensities, tie strengths, or something like that. And the graph clustering is just a partitioning of the set of nodes into non-empty subsets. Yeah, so you would put each node into one or more of these subsets. So if these subsets are disjoint, you would have a disjoint partition or an exclusive clustering approach. Like k-means, for example, is something, but k-means is metric, right? So something that follows the same lines of argumentation. But they could also be overlapping, right? That's perfectly possible. Now, if you have these subsets ci, we want to denote that by e of ci to cj, the set of all edges that go from nodes in ci to nodes in cj. Yeah? And if you have such a fat C clustering, E of fat C is the set of all clusters that go from nodes within a cluster to other nodes within the same cluster. E bar is the set of inter-cluster edges, right? So, well, clear. I mean, if these are your clusters and there are lots of edges in there, that's E of C. And all the ones that go between the clusters are E bar of C, right? As always, this denotes the induced subgraph, and we would have special names for special such partitionings. If we have only one such subset, yeah, so in essence, this is trivial because you take the set of nodes and say this is all a huge cluster, and this is called the one clustering. And if you put each node into its own cluster, it's called the singleton clustering. Both are called the trivial clusterings. And if k is equal to 2, so you split the node sets in two halves, if you want, then this thing is called a cut. Okay? A of g, set of all possible clusterings. And so if you would want to refine a clustering, what you would do, for example, is to take one of these subsets and split it in two, okay? So in this case, if ci is a subset of cj prime, then we would call c1 a refinement of c2 and c2 a coarsening. Well, that's only logical, okay? A chain is a set of comparable set of clusterings, a hierarchy. This would then lead to a dendrogram. And this hierarchy, this dendrogram is total if both of the trivial clusterings, the one clustering and the singleton clusterings, are both contained. Okay? And a cut function would kind of prescribe how a certain set of nodes, may it be one cluster, or may it be the whole set of nodes, we don't care, prescribe how this set of nodes should be split in two halves. Okay, so the cut function takes one subset of the set of nodes and maps it to its two cut constituents. Okay, and it's important, we only need one of them because the other one would just be the original minus that one, trivially. Okay, good. Now, F-clustering is all about quality measures, okay? And quality measures are kind of models for your clustering paradigm or for instantiating the clustering paradigm. So you know that you want to have intra-cluster coherence, and you know you want to have inter-cluster decoherence, but how do we model that mathematically? And the answer is we do that via these quality measures. So a quality measure is a mapping from the set of clusterings to the real numbers that kind of formalizes our clustering paradigm. Okay? As I said, we want to start with weighted graphs. And the weights are interpreted as tie strengths or similarities or whatever you want, okay? We can have negative weights, but in most cases it'll be better to map the weights to the unit interval, okay? Because then they're comparable across graphs, okay? With that notion, it's important to distinguish the case that we do have an edge, but it does have a weight of zero, from the case where we would have no edge at all, right? So formally, these are two different things, yeah? And so if we want to add up the weights of a set of nodes, whatever this E is, then we denote this as such, okay? And this is something that you would have all the time in that slide set. Any model would look like this, okay? So quality index is the sum of two terms, and the first term kind of formalizes what we call the intra-cluster density or coherence, where these two terms, density and coherence, are not actually the proper graph theoretic terms, because density has a graph theoretic meaning on its own. By density, with this notion, we subsume all of our possible intuitions about, that people stick together within the structure, okay? And G, the second ingredient, measures the intercluster sparseness or decoherence. And you may normalize this by this denominator here, but the problem is that the denominator already solves the complete problem. Yeah. So in essence, you will never be easily able to compute that, because if you maximize F plus G over all possible clusterings, what you find is the optimal clustering. So while this is a meaningful or reasonable normalization mathematically, practically it doesn't make sense. Okay? So what is done is that this is left out or replaced by V times V minus 1 or something. We will get to this. Okay? So this here, F plus G, is all we gotta see in this part of the lecture. Rest is just variance, okay? As with in this centrality part, okay? Good. Okay, so let's take ourselves 5 more minutes, okay? Much math today, so I'm gonna end up 10 minutes earlier, right? So that your brain would not protest. So the first measure that we could think of is coverage. Okay? Now, what is coverage? Obviously, coverage just measures the intra-cluster coherence. So it's a measure for F. And G, we would take as zero for the moment. And what this does is it sets into proportion the weights of the edges within the clusters to the total number of, or the total weight of all the edges, okay? And that appears to be a logical modeling, yeah? If this proportion is high, then we know that comparatively much of the weight is within the partition, okay? Or within the clusters. Now, the problem is that we have something that we might call a monotonous behavior, okay? Why is that? Okay, if we have a certain clustering C, and it has a number of clusters K, if we merge two or more clusters, and what we get is a C prime with a smaller number of clusters, what we always would have is that the coverage gamma of C prime would be larger than the coverage of the original clustering. So via merging two clusters, you could gain quality. Yeah. And everybody sees what this ends up at, namely that if we take the one clustering, we would have the maximum value of coverage, which is one. Yeah. So we cannot expect to find good intermediate solutions. So what we already see is that this simple intuition does not deliver a good quality index. So how can we do better than that? Okay. First example for doing better is conductance. Okay. That's something also quite famous. Appears in very many books and chapter and papers. So let's look at this. Good. So if we reformulate our clustering paradigm, what we can say is that clusters should be well connected in themselves, but what they should have is few intercluster edges and ideally none at all. Okay. So what conductance is in that definition down here is a measure for bottlenecks, okay? And a bottleneck formally is a cut that cuts through a set of nodes in such a way that very few edges are touched, okay? So let's look at this now. Good. Wipe it away. Thank you. Now we have the graph, okay? And we know that a graph just kind of separates the set of nodes in two halves. And the halves do not have to be of equal size. I just call them halves because we have two of them. This could also be a valid cut. This would not be present, okay? Good. So a cut just splits the set of nodes in halves. And what can happen? Okay, if the original graph looked like this, and very schematically, so there's a lot of edges going in there, but only a very few that just cut across to the other half. If you make the cut here, what you would have is you would minimize the weight of the edges going from one to the other, because there are so few, and we assume that they also have low weight, okay? Now, this, in a sense, is a natural clustering. This cut is already, or at least contributing to something that we might call natural, okay? And in that sense, this cut, this splitting in half, is a bottleneck if it really cuts across very few edges or edges with a low weight. Yeah, so that's why we call what we call a bottleneck. And conductance just formalizes that. And the essential definition is just down here. So in essence, conductance is proportional to the weight of the intercluster edges, period. Yeah, sum them up and you'd have conductance. What you just need is to normalize that. Yeah. And what we do is we normalize it by taking the minimum of these two expressions. And you would either take the weights of one half to itself and the rest of the graph and sum it up, or you would take the weights of the other graph to itself and the rest of the graph, yeah, if it has something else around, yeah, and you would take the minimum. So in a sense, you're optimistic, okay? And these are two special cases. So we set this conductance to one if the cut doesn't do anything non-trivial. Yeah, if the cut takes the whole set as one half and the empty set as the other, and if the combined weight of the intercluster edges is zero, we would set the conductance to zero. So in essence, we started from two disconnected components, yeah, which are connected only among themselves, but not from each other and to each other. And if that's the case, then this conductance is zero. So what we have is that the smaller this conductance of a cut is, the more bottlenecky this cut actually is. Yeah. And that will lead us in defining a proper quality measure. Good. And so we started with the conductance of such a cut. And the conductance of a whole graph is just computed by taking all the possible cuts and compute their conductance. Okay? So if the conductance of the whole graph is small, what we learn is that somehow there is a good cut possible. Yeah. So if that situation is there, yeah, like this, the original situation, we might as well do this cut. Yeah. One half, another half. But this is certainly, we would not give rise to a small conductance. Yeah. Because it's in a sense a stupid cut. But if the graph looks like this, we can make a good cut with a very small conductance as well. So this minimum is small also. Okay? So small conductance means good cut possible. Okay? And there's a simple theorem that we can easily prove, at least the one direction. If the graph is positively weighted and undirected, we get the maximum non-trivial conductance of 1 if the graph has at most 3 nodes or if it is a star. Yeah? So if we have these cases essentially or if it is a star. Why? I mean, you can imagine that those structures are in a sense not easy to cut. Yeah. So If you want to produce a non-trivial cut that cuts across something, yeah, you would always have that the combined weight of the intercluster edges is zero, okay? Or no, it's one. Zero, one. Let me just check. Intercluster edges. Okay, if you cut this, okay, yeah, naturally you get the maximum conductance. Okay, that's right. Okay, let's look at this in a more mathematical fashion. Yeah, let's assume we want to prove it the other way around. Yeah, so if it's connected and is of that nature, if it has at most 3 nodes or if it is a star. Why do we get this maximum conductance, meaning that these graphs are not easy to cut, in a sense? Okay, why is that? Okay, so the sum of the weights from one potential cut half to the rest of the graph would just be computed by being within the graph plus the weights of going to other such to the other half. Okay, so you'd have the graph, you have the cut, and if you want to compute this number here, you can certainly compute the weights that are within. So let this be C1 here. Okay, you can compute the weights within and the weights to the other half. Okay, and that's just the sum. So our definition for conductance would have the same numerator, but in the denominator here, where we just want to compute this, we can split up this into our two terms from here, right? And we would see W E bar, and the question is, what happens down here? Okay, so if we have a star, or if we have at most three nodes, then we see that the weights that are within the cluster always have a weight zero. Okay, let's make an example. Let's assume we cut here. Okay, so this node is isolated, and these are the rest of the nodes. And naturally, the weights within this substructure, which is just a single node, are zero. Okay, and you're always asked for the minimum. Okay, so in these cases, these things here, these W's, would be zero. So the minimum is zero, and one something over something is just one. Yeah. So that just tells us that these things are prototypes for being not very well to cut. Okay. And the conductance of a complete graph is somehow in between. Yeah. It's almost asymptotically 0.5. Yeah. So this is the exact theorem. If we have the complete graph, a clique, then it would have a conductance of 0.5. Once again, world is not friendly. Conductance appears to be nicer, makes more sense than the measure candidate we considered before. However, again, it's NP-hard. The only hope that we have is that we can at least approximate it within a certain guarantee, meaning that the true value is the approximation times this guarantee, and the guarantee is in log V, and even log V to the 1/2. So square root of log V. Even for large V, this number is comparatively small, right? So what you can do, you can approximate the conductance, okay? And the resulting quality measure would, for example, be just the minimum of the conductances of the clusters. Yeah, so that's the first candidate that uses conductance. And what we already see is that this just is a measure that models F and not G. Okay, so taking the minimum of all the CIs would give a good quality measure. Why? Okay, good. If F is small, what does that mean? It means that we, from all of these candidate cluster elements, or partition elements, one of them, at least one of them, has a small conductance. So it means that this special partitioning, so these are all of our clusters that we have, and one of them has a small conductance. It means that if we cut that in half, in essence it looks like this, like the one we had here. So it's possible to cut it such that the edges going from here to here have a low weight. Yeah, that means it's bottlenecky in a sense. So it's a good candidate to be split. Okay. And it means that the clustering has been two cores. Yeah. It's all nice, but this one needs splitting. Yeah. Before it was two cores, and we found that with the help of conductance. So in a sense, this version here is something that kind of formalizes the intra-cluster coherence. Yeah? And such a graph does not have a very good intra-cluster coherence because we can easily cut it in halves. Okay, and we need to do that such that this definition here is just a good quality measure. Okay, good. Oh, already I wanted to be off already. So that's something we're going to repeat next time. Okay, and we're going to look at some more examples, just a few. And this gives us an intuition how these things work, how you can find groups in networks. Okay, next time we're going to do that, and then we switch to data mining. So see you tomorrow, if some of you want to come. The others are invited to listen to the recording. See you.